A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, I'll chat with Judith Chernak, author of the new book, Schumann, The Faces and the Masks. The book explores the way Schumann referred to and employed different guises and personas throughout his work, including his music, commentary, and personal correspondence, and she'll outline some of these, as well as how his relationship with Clara is also reflected throughout his compositions and other writings. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. According to the New York Times, the New York Philharmonic has put two musicians on unpaid leave while the musicians' union investigates charges of misconduct. The Times reported that the Philharmonic spent 5 months investigating the accusations against principal oboe Liang Wang and associate principal trumpet Matthew Mucky. The charges were not specified in the Philharmonic statement to the newspaper. The Baltimore Symphony Orchestra is also under scrutiny, as its principal oboist has filed an EEOC complaint after the orchestra's own investigation of concertmaster John Carney for alleged misconduct concluded there was no hostile environment. Oboist Catherine Needleman told the Washington Post that she had been targeted by Carney beginning in 2005 and later faced retaliation. According to the Post, Carney's attorney called the EEOC complaint frivolous. The Post also reported that the orchestra's investigation recommended sensitivity training for Carney and other anti-harassment training for employees. Opponents of Rider University's proposed sale of Westminster Choir College to Chinese-based Kaiwen Education Technology Company have filed another suit to stop the sale, claiming the proposed agreement violates previous pledges to preserve the choir college's mission and existence. In the filing, which joins a previous suit filed by Princeton Theological Seminary, members of the Westminster Foundation, an independent group drawn from alumni, donors, faculty, and others concerned about the ongoing existence of Westminster, claim that Kaiwen's lack of long-term experience in music education and its ties to the Chinese government, which has faced criticism for cracking down on freedom of expression and religion, would imperil Westminster's academic integrity and its mission to teach music from the Western Christian tradition. At the core of the suit is the status of the trust created by Sophia Strong Taylor, who donated the land on which the college sits, that stipulates that the land would be turned over to the seminary should Westminster ever be unable to continue its mission. According to the filing, Rider assumed that obligation in 1992 when the schools merged. Rider is looking to sell the college and its campus to raise funds that it claims it needs to close its own budget shortfalls. Bruce Afran, an attorney for the foundation, said the agreement that Rider has reached with Kaiwen directly violates the intent of the trust.
The agreement they announced is that the academic program needs to be maintained only for 5 years, and that after 2 years, they can fire the faculty. So really, we're looking at something that allows Kaiwen, the buyer in China, which is a Chinese government-owned company, to begin to close this operation down in 2 years and to shut it down entirely in 5 years. And that's what we know from Rider's own announcement. They still won't show us the actual terms of the contract. So what we know is that under this agreement, as Rider has announced it, this school can be closed within 5 years. And that is directly contrary to the whole notion of the trust.
In this latest legal action, what are you seeking at this point?
Well, we're joining the seminary's existing lawsuit, which says much of the same thing. The seminary said that in 1991, it agreed to give up its right to take back this property, but only in exchange for a commitment by Rider to honor the purposes of the trust. So Rider has succeeded to this school and is obligated to continue to honor those purposes. It can't simply sell the school to a commercial buyer and have it just be shut down after 5 years. So we are seeking, just like the seminary, an order from the court declaring this sale is illegal, ordering Rider to continue operating Westminster as it has been, and at the same time begin the transition to spin Westminster off to other management, either independently or with other colleges.
Well, even in the short term, a number of concerns have been raised regarding the ability of the entity or entities that would be taking over Westminster to operate the school as closely to its tradition as it is supposed to, according to these agreements. Run us through some of the concerns regarding, first of all, the nonprofit status, and also just the cultural concerns that have been raised about where Westminster would be in the Kaiwen structure.
In our complaint, we show very conclusively that Kaiwen is a unit of the Chinese government. It may have some shareholders, but it is controlled by a majority owner that is a wholly government-owned company. And a lot of people go around saying, well, aren't all companies in China government-owned? The answer is no. Most of the big businesses we hear about are private companies in China. But this school is being sold to a Chinese investment company that is fully owned by the government of China. The government of China mandates that its officials do not practice religion, and this is partly a religious school, a teaching sacred music, and they mandate that all colleges and universities in China adhere to the Communist Party's social and governmental ideas. China has also recently been attempting to censor academic programs in the U.S., Britain, and Taiwan that conflict with Chinese government policy, and has threatened to hold back funds in joint programs in Western schools unless they made changes in their course offerings. Cambridge University was ordered, I think 2 years ago, to remove 300 scholarly articles about China or lose its connection to the Chinese government and joint programming. UC San Diego lost its funding from China when it hosted the Dalai Lama. And the State Department has identified dozens of instances in which religious and academic freedom has been interfered with by the government of China in terms of colleges and universities and religious groups. So we see that this school is going to be sold to a unit of the government of China that has a tradition of strengthening its resistance to academic freedom and religious freedom. And the academic integrity and freedom of this school is going to be lost under this ownership. What will happen is Ryder will gain its $40 million price, or whatever it nets out of this. Kaiwan will keep the $25 million endowment of Westminster and put it on its corporate books, as it said it will do in its stock exchange filing. And Westminster will disappear, lose its academic integrity, and its faculty can be fired within 2 years. So we're seeing the destruction of a 100-year-old leading cultural institution so that Ryder University can build a few new dorms for its students at Lawrenceville.
Afrin added that the outcome of the case could hold significance for other efforts by foreign governments to acquire American colleges. Larry Livingston, who was named by Ryder as president of Westminster Choir College Acquisition Corporation, created as a subsidiary of Kaiwen to seek nonprofit status and run the choir college, declined through a spokesman to comment on the filing. And finally, pioneering African-American ballet dancer Arthur Mitchell, who founded the Dance Theater of Harlem, has passed away. According to the New York Times, Mitchell died of heart failure at the age of 84. Mitchell gained national and international fame dancing with the New York City Ballet, working under George Balanchine. Following the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., he left to create the Dance Theater of Harlem. According to the Times, Mitchell first began formal dance training when he auditioned for Manhattan's High School of Performing Arts at the recommendation of a junior high guidance counselor. He later studied at Bennington College in Vermont and the School of American Ballet, then performed in modern dance and on Broadway before joining the New York City Ballet. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. When Robert Schumann published his sonata in F sharp minor, the dedication to the young Clara Wieck, later to be his wife, was not from Schumann himself, but Florestan and Eusebius, two of the personas who appear throughout his musical compositions and critical writings, each representing different aspects of Schumann and his personality. Schumann wove these faces and masks, as he himself referred to them, in various ways throughout his career, gradually diminishing over time, and they are the focus of a new book about the composer by Judith Chernak and published by Alfred A. Knopf. In her book, called Schumann, the Faces and the Masks, Chernak explores these personas more closely, including the way Schumann used them in his compositions and other writings, and also the way he channeled his emotions and alluded to his life experiences through his music. The book also delves into many of the deeply personal experiences and trials that shaped and affected Schumann, from his struggle with his future wife's father to win the right to marry her, to his subsequent decline and mental illness, probably the result of the syphilis that he had contracted in an earlier romantic affair. I recently spoke with Chernak, who holds a PhD from Yale University and is the founder of Poems on the Underground, about the book and the role that these faces and masks would play in Schumann's creative output.
He actually uses that expression himself when he's writing to Clara before their marriage about his early compositions, these wonderful suites for piano. And they started out as masquerades, that is, the masks refer to the actual masks that participants in a carnival masquerade would be wearing. And they also refer to the masks, theater masks of the happy and the tragic, the comic mask of the smiling face and the tragic mask of the sad face. And his early works, Papillon and Carnival, are based on these images of masks in masquerades. But he then wrote a piece which he called the Dances of the Davidsbündler. The Davidsbündler were the friends, some of them imaginary, some of them real, who were united in Schumann's mind and in his writings and in his music as a group of young, impassioned musicians and artists who were fighting the battle against the Philistines. And of course, the Philistines were in charge. They ruled the musical establishment then, as they rule many other bureaucracies at all times. So he wrote to Clara that he was sending her these dances, and he called them wedding dances because they had secretly become engaged. And these little pieces, they're short pieces mostly, but they're signed by his doubles, who were part of the masquerade, Floriston and Eusebius, who were also F&E. And Clara didn't like these dances as much as she liked Carnival, which was her absolute favorite piece. She played it all the time in public. Well, Schumann wrote to her that, in fact, these wedding dances represented his faces as opposed to the masks of the earlier works. So I thought this was a very good way of indicating that he had an inner self, which was his true self, and he assumed these masks, various masks, not only the happy one and the sad one, the comic one and the tragic one, but also masks of his various friends and of Clara herself in his music. And beneath them all, underneath, was the face, and that was Schumann's true personality, his true being. And then as I was doing my research into the book, and also playing a lot of his music on my piano, it occurred to me that it wasn't a single face that he had. It was a very multi-layered face. He had many moods, he had many personalities, and these all were expressed in his music. And they're what give his music its characteristic range, sometimes very joyful, sometimes very melancholy, and sometimes quite, flirtatious. Sometimes he's seems to be doing somersaults. It's like a whole array of clowns and masks and an array of the faces underneath the masks.
And as you document throughout the book, these faces and masks change and alter and take differing priorities and importance as his life progresses until the point where it seems as though towards the end, the masks and the faces really are now just revealing more of his true self. How did you see that progression going in?
Well, yes, I see it as a tragic unfolding of his destiny, which was a very sad one. I mean, at the very end, I think his music reflects his own awareness that he has not long to live and he might be facing a very terrible way of ending his life. Because I think it's now that nobody else seems to have said this. He knew that he had syphilis when he was 21 years old. He documents this in his diary. And his diaries of Schumann's were kept by all the family. In fact, I think Clara transcribed them, and it seems a bit odd that she never seems to have said anything about this episode in his life. Maybe she didn't transcribe this particular diary. Anyway, the family kept all this material. There was no attempt at censorship. And he expresses a fear of going mad at various times in his life. And I think this was always related to his fear that the syphilis hadn't been cured, because he hoped that it was cured. It was treated, as it was at the time, with arsenic or something he calls Narcissus water, which was probably something of the same sort of thing. Anyway, it was very well known that syphilis, for many people, ended in madness. And I think this is what he feared, and I think it's expressed in that very late music. There's a very tragic element in it, a sense of foreboding, and that's what I see as his final face or his final reality. Mm-hmm. It's a very sad one.
Well, regarding the concept of destiny, one of the things that he also truly held on to, particularly probably is one of the defining aspects of his life, is his relationship with Clara and the fact that so early on, even though there were a few other women in between there, he saw Clara as part of his destiny. You place Clara very prominently within the book in this relationship. What role did Clara play in his life and in his career as a musician, as a composer?
Well, one of the fascinating things about his music, and again, people have written about this, but it seemed to me that it's never been given sufficient weight. She was a composer. Now, her father, which is very unusual for, you think of women at that time in any profession being restricted and, you know, held back. But she was motherless in all, to all effect. I mean, her mother had left her father when she was a small child. And it was her father who promoted her career. And he encouraged her to compose. He had her take harmony lessons. And, you know, he was very, very intent on making her into a great pianist, but also a composer, because pianists at that time often played their own compositions. I mean, this is true of Chopin. He was a pianist, but he happened to be a great composer as well. True of Mendelssohn, and would have been true of Schumann if he hadn't injured his hand so he couldn't be a pianist. That is, a virtuoso pianist. Anyway, Clara composed, and her father published every one of her compositions as soon as she wrote them. So they were published even before Schumann's compositions were published. She was a child, but she was a prodigy. And this had tremendous appeal to concertgoers, and her father took absolutely full advantage of it. So what Schumann did then was to take elements of her early compositions and use them in his own music. And sometimes he'd use them as a theme on which he wrote variations, but sometimes he just kind of buried them without acknowledgement in a way that meant he was speaking to her, and nobody else was supposed to know this. Until people like me found out about it, you know, many years later. But anyway, it's a very, very interesting aspect of his composition, because there they are, the two of them, speaking to each other through their music, because Clara knew about this, and she also used some of his music in her compositions as time went on. She didn't write very much, but what she did was published. And it's lovely. It's not like Schumann's music. It's very much of the time. It's more like Mendelssohn, in fact. But it's charming. And Schumann really thought of her as a wonderful artist in all ways, including her composition. But you ask what she meant to him in terms of his career and his life, his happiness. I think they were very much in love. I mean, as far as one can tell from these ecstatic love letters that they wrote. And they wrote them even after they were married. They had a joint diary, and sometimes Clara in this diary, which of course has been published and translated, though it was meant to be very private. Sometimes Clara says, as a young bride, she was 9 years younger than Schumann, and she felt in awe of him, as she thought he was a great composer, a genius. And sometimes she felt that she wasn't quite making him happy, and maybe he was a bit short with her, you know, or she was imagining it. So they had this joint diary, marriage diary, which they took turns writing each week. One of them would write, and then Sunday mornings over coffee, they'd read the diary together, and presumably they would sort out any difficulties that were mentioned in the course of the diary. Anyway, my sense is that she was absolutely devoted to him, and he depended on her as his muse, his wife, his beloved Clara, right up to the end. I think that one of the saddest things about his final years when he was in a mental asylum, the series of letters he wrote to Clara, And they're full of love, but as if through glass, as if he's just trying to reach out and hold on to her. They're absolutely, you know, heartbreaking. But I think it was the closest relationship imaginable.
And also the sad fact that he was unable to see her until almost the last moment during those last few years.
I think it was because when he was taken to the hospital initially, everyone hoped, including the doctors, that if he was kept in a state of absolute calm, containment is the term they use now. It's still the treatment for a manic episode or delusional episode. But if the patient is kept quiet and contained, there's a hope of recovery. In fact, there's often a certainty of recovery within a certain time. And it would have been very distressing for Clara to visit him or for him to see her when he was in that state. So I think it started with advice to, you know, that he would recover, he might recover, or he would recover if nobody visited him, if he was just kept calm and quiet and probably sedated. But later, you know, then when he wasn't recovering, when he was delusional and violent, it would have been terrible for her to see him. And she kept a diary during this time in which she wrote that she was tortured by the fact that she couldn't see him. And wouldn't it be better if she waited until he was cured? That was her, you know, the way she reassured herself. And it was only when he was dying that the doctor wrote to her that if she wanted to see him, she should come immediately, which she did with Franz and Joachim.
Well, given the correspondence between the two of them and also the other, his diaries, which stretch back quite a ways, and his other correspondence, is there a sense that we perhaps know a little bit more or have even more insight to his body of work than perhaps some other composers that draw as much attention?
Well, I think his body of work is remarkably autobiographical, and that just isn't true. I mean, you think, you know, when Mozart wrote the G minor symphony is because he was feeling tragic. Well, I don't think that's so. You know, he wrote everything he wrote. He wrote it as a brilliant composer. And Beethoven, you can identify some autobiographical elements in his work, but not in the whole body of work. In Schumann's case, it's completely different. He said himself that everything in the world affects him and gets expressed in his music. And by everything in the world, he meant not only his love of Clara, which is very, very evident in his music all the way through. I mean, he even has special themes that signify her name and that spell her name, but also his sense of politics in the world, his reading, which was absolutely phenomenal. He was a great reader, and he read the classics. He read German literature, but he read a huge amount of English literature and translations to Walter Scott, Byron, even read a bit of Shelley at the end when it was translated into German. And he put everything into his music. And I think that's very unusual. I mean, I can't think of another composer where you could say, you know, one of the major composers where you could say that that's true of the whole body of work, maybe of certain particular works, but not of the whole body of work.
What was it in particular about Schumann that really inspired you to delve in and write this?
I did start out not as a pianist, but I played the piano and I took piano lessons. And one of the pieces I studied was the piano concerto. And I played it with my music teacher playing the orchestral part on a second piano. And this was in the music school I attended, which actually still exists. It's the Brooklyn Music School, and near the 7th Avenue stop of the what used to be called the Brighton Line. And I used to go there every Saturday and take my piano lessons and theory lessons and so on. And it was just such an inspiring thing to work on this great concerto, to be able more or less to play it, and then to play it with the orchestral part on another piano in front of a very small audience. I think it consisted of my parents and a few other, you know, friends and relatives. But it was so exciting. And somehow that stayed with me. And I've always loved his music. And when I learned about the life, more about the life, somehow the two things, the music and the life, seemed just like a subject that I wanted to write about. You know, I've never written a biography before. I have written novels, And I did write a book about Shelley, Shelley's poetry. And I suppose poetry and music have been my great loves ever since childhood. And I've never written poetry, but I did start a program of poems on public transport, which I think exists in several cities in America, as well as in London, where I started it, where I live. Anyway, it's just been a wonderful thing to really delve into the life and all of the music. I mean, I knew quite a lot of it, but certainly not as much as I do now.
And who was your intended audience? Who were you hoping to reach and share all of this with?
I wrote it for the general reader. I'm not sure who the general reader is. I hope the general reader exists in large numbers, because I do believe that the arts belong to everybody. I think the arts speak for the imagination, and that's particularly true of Schumann. I mean, his work is so imaginative, and I think it really speaks to the heart. So between the heart and the imagination, I should think that the general reader could find this life and the music very appealing. I hope so. You know, I think I don't have musical examples, so I discuss music, but I refer to the music available on the internet. I think that's a great, I mean, it has its faults, but it's a great democratic force in that it opens so many things to people without regard to their educational background or their specialized knowledge or their professional life. It's just there to be enjoyed, really. And I hope that people will be tempted to, you know, to listen to the works that are, you know, that are available there, and also to read about this very troubled and yet very productive and joyful life.
Well, you referred to your love of the piano concerto. What are some of the works that you discovered in writing this that maybe have become your favorites or one of your favorite pieces of his?
Well, I'll tell you, the chamber music, which I really didn't know. There are three trios. There are two trios written at the same time, and then one written quite a bit later. And two violin sonatas, and above all, three string quartets, which are absolutely wonderful. And I think, you know, every quartet looks for special works of music to record and to perform. And more, I think, you know, the younger quartets now, and there are wonderful, wonderful groups forming all the time. I think they're looking at Schumann's string quartets in a new way, because they are really beautiful and somewhat neglected until recent times, I think. And the trios, too. I mean, especially there's a trio in D minor. He seems to have been very fond of the key of D minor. You know, I think they're just wonderful.
That was Judith Chernak, author of Schumann, The Faces and the Masks, published this month by Alfred A. Knopf. More information on the book is available at penguinrandomhouse.com. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world each week on A Tempo. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.